Hello, I'm Brian Earle, your host for The Zesty Garden, and in studio with me this morning is Brent Black. He's USU's Extension Fruit Specialist, in studio live for about the first 15 minutes. And if you'd like to get in a question or comment, call us toll-free at 1-800-826-1495. That's 1-800-826-1495. Or go online, send us an email question at zestygarden@gmail.com. Thanks, Brent, for coming in.
Thanks for having me back.
Okay, so there's plenty to talk about here. One of the first things that I wanted to look at is some of the ripening issues real quick. So last month, I think we were talking about pears?
Yeah,
we talked about peaches. Mm-hmm. Are apples the same? You cut into them and you see the seeds have gone dark brown.
That's one of the indicators. So for apples, the strategy for determining when they're ripe, part of it is the seed color. Part of it is actually the firmness of the flesh. So commercial growers will actually measure flesh firmness. So as an apple ripens, it will soften, and you can determine as it starts to soften, that means it's getting close. There's the other indicators besides that are actually the color on the shaded side of the fruit. And that depends on variety. Now, Red Delicious, you're going to get so much pigment there that you're not going to really be able to see that. But what they call the bicolor apples, like a Fuji and a Gala and so forth, if you look on the back side of the fruit or the shaded side of the fruit, that's going to go from green to more of a yellow background. They call it the background color. And once that happens, once the chlorophyll is degraded, the green pigment is degraded, then that's usually an indication that you're getting close to ripeness.
Now, I have two other indicators. One would be looking to see the birds that are flying into the tree and pecking on my apples.
How many bird pecks you
have? Oh, my
right?
Heavens. Gala this year, there's just a ton of apples on it, and the finches are just... They don't even eat at my bird feeder anymore with the sunflower seeds. They were in that tree, and I've got peck holes and
right.
and a ton of them.
So, and that's the indicator is flavor. So with apples, what happens over the course of the season is they accumulate starch, which is the storage form of carbohydrates. And then as they ripen, the starch is converted to sugar. So you can taste that very easily. I mean, if you bite into an apple and it tastes like a raw potato, that's the starch. So as that starchiness goes away and the sugar develops, that's a real good indicator of ripeness.
So if it
tastes
good, won't pick it.
Right.
So
that's how a big way it differs from pears, because pears need to after ripen. They need to be taken off the tree, refrigerated, and then put back at room temperature to finish ripening.
So with apples, when you have a tree with that many apples on it, can you usually pick them all at once, or do you have to? Does it start at the top and work its way to the bottom?
Usually, you're going to get the best quality if you pick the ones that are most sun exposed, near the top of the tree, near the outside of the tree. Those will ripen the earliest, and then you watch for that color development. They call it color picking. You go through, and the ones that are fully ripe, usually on the outside of the tree, you pick first, and then you might come back and pick them over a 10-day period, and you're going to get a lot better quality. If you try and pick them all at once, you're going to get some that might be a little overripe, some that might be just a little bit underripe. And so by doing multiple pickings, you're going to get a better
so end product.
So this
particular tree, when I bought it, in the catalog, it said packs out at 95%. Does that mean that I can pick 95% of the tree? I mean, it tends to ripen more all at once.
Packs out
red is what it says.
Yeah, that's so what they've done is they've selected color sports that have increased pigment. So some galas are redder than other galas. There's different strains of gala. And so they'll select for one that has a higher incidence of color or higher saturation of color so that they can get a better pack out. So that's a lot of that has to do with the color development of the strain.
So packing out just meaning that...
And another factor with pack out is how uniformly the fruit size, which is a little different issue.
Well, and this one tends to be smaller anyway.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
What about when to pick? So I know when I talked with Dan Drost about melons, he says to pick your melons in the afternoon because then you have a higher sugar content. But I can't see an apple moving moisture in and out quite that quick.
It doesn't move it out in and out quite as quick. The big factor with fruit, with tree fruit and berries even more so, is how quickly you can cool the fruit down after it's picked. So yes, you might get a little bit higher sugar content in the afternoon and in the morning, not so much with apples, but maybe for berries. But the real kicker is the quicker you can cool that fruit after it comes off the plant, the longer the post-harvest life is going to be.
Hmm.
So oftentimes we recommend that you pick in the morning, because then you don't have, the fruit hasn't had a chance to heat up. It's cool already. You can get it into the fridge or wherever, and it's going to have a lot longer post-harvest life. If you pick it in the afternoon and the fruit temperature is high, and then you don't get it chilled down quickly enough, then it really limits post-harvest life quite a bit.
Or you can do what I did a couple of years ago, and I had a floodlight and picked it at like 10 o'clock, 10:30 at night.
There you go. That'll work. So as the fruit's cooling off again, yeah.
Okay. Moving along, because we have a number of things to talk about. What about containers? Can you put fruit in a container? Or do you have to get, if you can, special varieties?
So with the container, so there's a couple of issues that come into play with growing fruit in containers. One is, do you have enough root volume? And that's going to be determined by by what the crop is and the variety and the root stock. So if you're going to, say, do a fruit tree in a container, that can work if you can get a dwarfing root stock, because the dwarfing root stock is going to contain the size of that tree.
And not a semi-dwarf. It's got to be really dwarf.
Yeah, full dwarfing. Because a semi-dwarf tree, you might need a container that's, you know, you're talking about major street planters, you know, 4-foot diameter and 3 feet deep or something like that. They have to be fairly large. But if you go to the fully dwarf ones, you can go to a smaller container. The other issue besides the container size, matching the container size to the crop, is root zone temperature. So as you go to a smaller container and you put it on your patio, in our climate where we have fairly intense sunlight, if that's going to be out in the sun, the root zone temperature during the middle of the day can get very hot. And the leaves can tolerate hotter temperatures than the roots. And so we did some studies several years ago here in Cache Valley, and we had really hard time growing certain crops in containers just because of the root zone temperature in the middle of the summer. It, you know, the best way to get around that is drip irrigation several times a day to keep the root zone as hydrated as you can, but also maybe painting your container white, putting some mulch on the top, anything to keep. The other thing that people will do is actually bury the pot in the ground so that it can dissipate some of the heat and have some insulation from the sun.
That way you can still move
anything, right. Anything to keep the root zone temperature cooler during the summer. Then the flip side of that is, if we're going to grow a perennial like an apple tree, what are we going to do with it in the winter?
Because that's going to freeze solid.
Right. The branches of an apple tree will take minus 20, minus 25, minus 30, even if the tree is appropriately acclimated. The roots will be dead by the time you get to 0 degrees, because the ground, the upper surface of the upper layers of the ground will freeze, but it never gets to the real extreme temperatures, and the roots just aren't really designed to handle really extreme temperatures. And when you've got a pot, and particularly a small pot, that's going to be a problem. So one of the things that you can do if you want to grow them in pots is heel them into your garden during the winter.
Explain what healing is.
So dig a little hole, put the pot down in the ground and put soil around it, and maybe put some straw bales or even loose straw or wood chips or something over the top to keep that root from being frozen. Because if it gets frozen solid through and gets down to, say, 15 degrees Fahrenheit, the roots are going to be dead. And so that's the other issue you have to deal with.
Could you bring it into the garage? As
yes.
long as you are, you're going to have to water it.
Yeah.
So you
don't have to water it a lot. Usually if you get it hydrated and move it into the garage, you might have to go out and put a little bit of water on it a couple of times over the course of the winter. Typically the garage, and it depends on your garage, but typically that's going to keep it stable enough that you can, that they'll do just fine. And we were doing some studies a few years back with apples and peaches and so forth in containers. And one of the things we did is, once the trees were dormant and the leaves were dropping, we would move them into a big root cellar, and they were out of the sunlight the whole tree, the pot, everything was in a root cellar, and we'd leave them there for months and then bring them out. And they did just fine in that kind of environment. And that works very well. So you're going to have to think about your summer management, keeping the root zone cool. You're going to have to think about your winter management, keeping the roots from freezing. And then making sure that, number one, the container is appropriate for the size of the crop. And number two, that you're watering adequately, and which means you may need to put it on some kind of automated system where you're watering it several times a day with a little bit of water just to keep that root zone appropriately hydrated.
And in a container, you're going to have to fertilize it.
Yeah, and that's the trick also. I mean, even with really good potting soil, the nutrient holding capacity can be, you know, that reserve of nutrients can be exhausted very quickly. So another thing you can do is get like a little fertilizer injector and so that you're putting on a little bit of fertilizer maybe once a week or even every time you water.
So that's going to take a little bit of work.
It can work. I mean, I know people that grow a lot of bonsai plants and things, which is a small container, which is also the same principles. And you just, it's going to take more management than if you have it in the garden planted in the soil.
What about if you're looking for fruits in smaller areas, maybe not necessarily in a container? I've seen some of these apples that are colonnade. Is that what they're called? And they're columnar. They don't get much taller than about 5 feet, and they don't have side branching. It's just one, looks like a tall whip,
right?
What I would call a whip, and then the fruit comes on.
Right.
On
that. So there's two things that contribute to that. There's the columnar growth habit is a genetic condition of the sine. So they can select a variety that has a very columnar habit, and then they're putting it on a dwarfing rootstock to keep it so that column doesn't get 30 feet tall. It stays a manageable size. And so that combination, now you're not going to get, oftentimes if they're selecting a columnar variety, it may not be, you know, it's not a variety you're going to be familiar with the fruit, but it's going to be similar to something that you know.
Okay, so we have about 3 minutes left. Talk about the Master Gardener Field Day.
Yes. So once a year, the state Master Gardener organization puts together a field day. This year, it's going to be at the Greenville Research Farm here in North Logan, just north of the university campus. And so you've asked in the past, when can I come and see your research plots? And that's what we're going to do this year. There's going to be topics on pest management, on vegetables, on fruit, water-wise landscaping. It's an all-day affair. If you want to get involved, contact your county agent. They can give you information on how to register for that. There is a registration fee. And so you've got the dates there.
And it's September 17th, 8:30 to 4:30. So it's all day. The cost is $55 at the Greenville Research Farm on 12th East.
Eighth East
here in Logan, and they're fruit integrated pest management, field vegetable research, new invasive pests to watch out for, effects of pesticides on pollinators, and more. There's a tour of the bee lab and the Greenville Waterwise Native Ornamental Tour organic farm. Lunch is included. So again, it's $55 for September 17th, 8:30 to 4:30 p.m. And contact your county extension agent.
Right.
Okay. So in the last minute and a half, can you prune this time of year?
Well, it's summer pruning. There's not a lot of benefits because the benefits of summer pruning would have been earlier. At this point, really, you want to wait till dormant pruning, because for most fruit trees, the benefit of a summer pruning is past. We're too late for that, and the next thing is dormant pruning.
But I can imagine you could still take out. I mean, if you've got an older tree that you didn't get started on earlier, you could take out the crossing branches. Mm-hmm. You could take out anything that's dead or not doing what.
So one of the things, if you prune this time of year, it's going to reduce the overall vigor. Whereas if you wait till it's dormant, you're going to increase that vigor.
So with a dead branch, if you've got something that's not even growing,
if it's completely dead, it's not going to affect it one way or the other. One of the concerns that I have is if you make some heavy pruning cuts this time of year
and go into the live tissue,
you're going to stimulate new growth. That new growth is not going to become hardy in time to
those are the water sprouts,
right?
And I've learned that lesson the hard way.
Right.
I still pruned in the spring, but I pruned too much, and so I ended up getting tons and tons of the water sprout.
Right.
Especially with pears. They seem to, at least the ones I've got, tend to do that.
Yeah.
So, okay. Well, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Brent Black is USU's Extension Fruit Specialist and comes in each month, and we'll have him back in again. Coming up next is more for the Zesty Garden. This is the Zesty Garden, and I'm talking with Grant Cardin, USU Extension Soil Specialist. And I thought I would just ask a basic question. Why are our soils the way that they are? Why do we have so little organic matter? Why? I mean, because on one hand, I love living in the West because there are fewer insects that you have to deal with, fewer pathogens, and it's just, you know, the drier air helps
lower
so
humidity,
much,
yeah.
And lower humidity. But at the same time, it comes at the expense of, you know, what's in our soil. We just don't have the higher content of organic matter.
Right. We live in an environment that there's far more water use or consumption, evapotranspiration we call it, compared to how much precipitation we receive. And so we're always at a deficit for water, and hence we don't get a lot of accumulation of organic materials in the soil. When they do become available, there's microbes in the soil that are starved for that as a food source, and they tend to process it, decompose it, burn it up pretty quickly. It doesn't get a chance to really accumulate in our soils. We also have, because of that high evaporative condition, a lot of salts and minerals that are left behind in our soils as you know, the water is removed. And so over the eons of time that these soils have been sitting here developing in the western kind of semi-arid and arid areas of the states and the rest of the world for that matter, we've accumulated a lot of salts and other materials, minerals in the soils.
Because they haven't been flushed through.
They haven't been flushed through, yeah. So you have we have a lot of what we, in this area, calcium carbonate or lime, in excess in our soils. And
where's that coming from?
That's coming just from the dissolving of limestone and other materials that are here in the area. And so they dissolve in the water, and as the water then evaporates away, it leaves those down behind in the soils, and they reprecipitate into these lime materials in our soil layers. And so, you know, most of our soils in the West in Utah can be anywhere from 15 to 40 plus percent calcium carbonate or lime by weight, by mass. And so there's a lot of that material in our soils. And as that dissolves, when it comes in contact with acid materials, it consumes the acid, and it buffers the pH right at about 7.5 to 8. And so most people will take a soil and have it tested here in Utah, and that's right where their pH will fall. And you can almost, you know, predict that ahead of time, knowing, you know, what our overlying conditions have been for a long, long time.
Did it always used to be that way? I mean, I'm imagining when there was a wetter climate, that when there was more vegetation growing and so forth, that maybe that wasn't the case.
Right.
Because I'm sure there are other places in the country that have the lower pH, but they've got a lot of limestone as well.
They do. You mean in terms of like the rock materials and things? That's right. And so we do see, you know, if we assume that those mechanisms were operative when it was wetter even here, then the resulting soils in those areas show that they're lower in pH. And so we would have expected that would have been the case here too as well. There's just so much accumulated now, it's hard to see any you know, old record of that in our soils. But we have a lot that is caused by that buffering of pH that we have to deal with the growth of plants in these environments. So things like the micronutrients, iron, zinc, calcium sometimes even, become very hard for the plant to take up because they are kept insoluble at these higher pHs.
Even calcium?
I mean, you have some problems with, because, you know, the free calcium sometimes will precipitate and be less available, and there'll be other things that restrict its uptake. And so, you know, yeah, you can see difficulties with a lot of the nutrients that are used in low quantities in plants.
Is the pH up a lot of our canyons? Tend to be lower in the soil there.
They do. In fact, if you go up into the canyons, you can find pHs that are neutral or lower. And in some pockets, even down in the valleys, you'll find at the mouth of canyons where they haven't had a lot of accumulation from over time with the waters and things like that that have flowed into them. They can be a little bit closer to neutral in their pH.
And that's because of all there's more moisture falling in the form of snow and rain up in the mountains, and so more plants are growing.
Right, and they're coarser soils. They tend to be sandy and gravelly the more you get into the foothills and the mountains. If you look at Cache Valley, for instance, or many of the valleys here in the state of Utah and throughout the West in the Basin and Range area, you've had these inland seas that were present tens of thousands of years ago here. And so as materials washed out of the mountains and into those large lake areas, the heavy stuff settled out first, the gravel and sand along the benches, and then the silts a little bit further down on the toe slopes, and then out in the valleys, the clays tended to accumulate. And so you see this continuum of the changes in the texture of soils as you go from the benches down into the valleys.
And
that's right, because those salts are retained more in the finer textured soils, the clays and silts, than they are in the coarser textured soils. So the ones that are up in the mountains and in the benches, they allow a lot more water movement through them, and so they typically will be often much more leached, even though we're in an arid environment, than the soils further out in the valleys.
And I'm going to ask a geologic question, and please say, well, I know you're not a geologist, but yet you're working with soils.
Right.
So when I'll just work with Cache Valley here. So when the valley was initially formed, it wasn't as nice and sloping. I'm assuming it was a little more,
far more rugged. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, yeah. So our valley has really just been filling in from the surrounding areas.
It has.
And that would explain also why the valley tilts toward the west a little bit. I mean, there's a fault over there on the west side of the valley, but there aren't as many mountains on that side either. So.
Yeah. This uplift in the Rockies is altered things, because you have had, you know, along fault lines, some drop in the valleys just along the fault lines. But most of the materials we see, at least in the surface, have accumulated in the bottoms of inland seas. And so they have accumulated to great depths, actually, in as that material's then filled in the low areas in our valleys over time. And so you do see this pretty commonly all across the state, where you have the benches and the old lake terraces and things like that, that you'll see that are pretty gravelly and sandy, then moving into the silty soils on the toe slopes and the clay soils out in the valleys because of that. And, you know, the higher the clay content, typically the higher the salt content and other things, just because it doesn't leach as well and accumulates higher contents over time.
I don't know if this has anything to do with it, but they call Cache Valley as being a higher mountain valley. And I know it's only a couple hundred feet higher than Salt Lake, but it's smaller, so it's filled in a little bit more maybe. I don't know.
It has, and we've also, since we're kind of a closed bowl at the south end, we get a lot of dust and things blowing in from southern Idaho and other places that have also accumulated in Cache Valley. So we have an interesting thing where we have a lot of Snake River Basin soil materials that have blown in over time and also accumulated here. And so you see a kind of an interesting difference in Cache Valley soils than you see in many of the other areas around the state.
I find that fascinating, actually. That's really kind of cool. So when I was last in Paradise, I was at Weeks Berry Farm, and they're growing blueberries.
Blueberries, yeah.
Now,
but we'd all like to try.
I've always been told, don't grow blueberries, but in talking with them and understanding a little more about how they're doing things, even though the pH is a little bit lower where they are, the soil is so yellow because of all of the sulfur that they're adding to keep that pH down. And then I think they have overhead drip system so that they can water with a controlled water that's not the groundwater here. Otherwise, the pH would be rising again. So
also
it's a pretty
acidified.
Intense operation.
Yeah, that Merv spends a lot of time, he and his boys, battling pH rise in their raised beds and in their soils down there. They have kind of a little unique pocket up there that's more neutral pH to start with. But like you said, the water still carries in dissolved lime, calcium carbonate in it. We all deal with hard water, you know, in the state, and you'll see the lime deposits on your faucet tips and, you know, things like that, that white crusty precipitate that forms. We all deal with that, the cloudy scum on our dishes, you know, that sticks there. Those are lime deposits. And so we're always dealing with it in the water as well. And so, yeah, they do battle a lot. They treat the water with sulfur so they can bring it down in pH. They treat the beds with large quantities of sulfur in order to manufacture sulfuric acid as that material oxidizes and try to keep those pHs down. Because the blueberries, you know, they are happiest in environments at 5 to 5.5 pH. And, you know, we're at 7.5 to 8, which on a logarithmic scale is a whole lot more.
So basically, unless your last name is Weeks, don't try growing blueberries.
It's hard to find places throughout the state where you can really drive the pH down because of it. And to just give you a problem of scale, for instance, 1% lime, and we said our soils are 15 to 40%, 1% lime in the top foot of an acre represents about 40,000 pounds of lime or 20 tons of lime material. That's buffering any pH change. So all of that would have to be dissolved before you could actually lower the pH. And so, you know, you start looking at the scale of the issue. You know, we're talking 15 to 40 times that amount of lime typically in soils. And it's kind of a non-starter when it comes to excess lime in terms of dropping pH in our soils. So we have to do things to manage for the lack of nutrient availability in our soils by, you know, properly placing or timing our applications of iron and zinc and other things to account for the fact that they can be really quickly made insoluble in our soil.
So what you're saying is that I could dump a whole bunch of sulfur in my garden. I'm on one of those, the tail slopes, not quite into the valley, but pretty close to it. So I could dump a whole bunch of sulfur, and because of the amount of calcium carbonate that's in the soil, I'm not going to be doing really any good at all.
Not a whole lot. You know, for a pound of elemental sulfur, you're going to generate about 2 pounds of sulfuric acid. And you'd have to generate pound for pound pure sulfuric acid to dissolve a pound of calcium carbonate. So, you know, you're talking about huge quantities. And you probably can't afford that much sulfur, and it would just be a management nightmare to try to do that.
Well, let's go the other direction then and talk about iron, because that seems to be a lot of the issues that we have with the higher pH, that when we're growing plants not native to here, like raspberries, for instance, and blackberries, strawberries, they get chlorotic. The leaves go yellow, can even be burnt on the edges, and then you see green veins in the middle, and that's a good indication that they're just not pulling up enough iron. So we use what I know is chelated iron and put that on the plant, or at least in the soil in the spring, and you could even spray it as a foliar spray, but to help that along. So let's talk about what chelated iron is and how it helps the plant.
Chelates are really long chain organic molecules that have a lot of absorptive sites on them. And what they'll do is they'll hold on to zinc or iron or other nutrients, particularly the metal nutrients like zinc and iron. And as they decompose, they'll slowly release that material. Some of it can be readily exchanged. Some of it takes longer as it breaks down to be released. And so it becomes kind of a metered delivery mechanism. Putting iron salts like iron sulfate into the soil dissolve so quickly, then they become available for all these reactions that make them almost immediately insoluble, pretty quickly insoluble in soils. So to put them in a chelate to protect them from those reactions and then have kind of a slow release mechanism available to you over time is a little bit better delivery. It's a lot more expensive than some of the mineral salts of iron and other nutrients, but they can, like you say, you can apply those foliar, and so that the material can absorb through the
so
leaves.
So it has immediate
effect. Immediate effect. You can use it as soil drenches so that the material's there, and then as it slowly breaks down, it can release the nutrient. But whenever you're applying a mineral like iron that's difficult for the plant to take up, it doesn't translocate much in the plant. It doesn't move, in other words, from one spot to another in the plant very readily. And so you want to try to get it either into the soil or on the plant surfaces early in the spring when the leaves are starting to expand, before they're fully expanded, or it won't really get where it needs to be to help with the, I mean, because iron's an important part of chlorophyll and energy transfer compounds in the leaf. And so that's why you get that chlorosis or that yellowing. It's the lack of the chlorophyll and the lack of some of those energy transformation compounds that are there.
So this would explain why when I told my father-in-law he needs to use chelated iron on his grapes and his raspberries, and I think he had some strawberries that had some issues, it was too late in the year. The plant just wasn't pulling them up, and so he would have had to have sprayed them on directly onto the leaves themselves for it to have any effect.
Right, and even then, sometimes you're late enough that you've suppressed the growth enough early on that So to get it on in the spring is really the best. Get it into the leaf as it's beginning to expand.
How early in the spring would you put it on the soil and just kind of scratch it into the soil?
As close to the time when the leaves are going to be fully expanded in the canopy, because that's when the shoots are really bringing stuff up and putting it in the leaves, and then it's going to sit there and reside in the leaf from that point on. It's not going to really move.
Hmm. So you don't want to put it on too early, because then you're just wasting the iron. It's being released, but there's nothing there to pick it up. But like with my raspberries, for instance, when I first start seeing them poking up above the ground, should I put it on like a week before or?
Yeah, a week to 2 weeks before, and you can really get that stuff beginning to break down and being released so that it's available to the roots. And the same thing with any kind of foliar application. Get it on when those leaves are beginning to expand and open up in the springtime.
Just when I think I'm just getting to know everything, I know nothing.
You know, it's the art of plant management. You know, there's some scientific principles, but then you got to kind of work with it a little bit and kind of get used to how your plants respond to various things. But we do see some real benefit in plants where we make these micronutrients that suffer for availability because of the high pH that we really can't do a whole lot for when we apply it in soil in chelated form and in foliar applications with the chelate. Now, one of the things you can do with the mineral salts, which are quite a bit less expensive, is to put plugs around a tree or a shrub or a hedge, like a raspberry hedge or something like that, where you open up a 2 foot deep hole, a small diameter hole, like with a soil probe or something mm-hmm. like that. And then you backfill that open hole with a 50-50 mixture of iron sulfate and elemental sulfur. You have to put a lot of these in there. You're basically making your own plant growth stake or fertilizer stake in the ground, right?
And but it's 50-50 iron sulfate and
elemental sulfur. Yeah, and you can buy both of those pretty readily at your garden stores and things like that. That will allow some really readily soluble iron to be in a zone of enrichment that the roots can grow into, rather than it being available for bulk reaction in the soil. And as the sulfur oxidizes over time, it can re-dissolve some of that that's then precipitated out as the sulfuric acid's manufactured over time.
And how do you put this in the drip line?
Yeah, right along the drip line of the hedge or the tree or the shrub, and you'll put every foot or two around the outside of the drip line one of these cores and fill it back up with the material. And so we do see some benefit that way, but it takes a lot of work. It's pretty labor intensive, and you have to do it fairly readily.
But if you've got a tree that you really like and want to keep, then it would be worth having.
It would be worth doing.
Now this, also the light bulb's going on because I've got a Gala apple, and it's just bizarre. One side of the tree, like a quarter of it, is the branches just have a hard time pulling up enough iron. And it's just weird. It's like, why is the other side of the tree okay and this one not?
Yeah.
Is it really that close?
It can, yeah.
In the soil, as far as the pH?
The soil properties can vary just a little bit from, feet away from where you might be. There's an interesting thing that goes on. And I live up in the bench in North Logan, and we have pretty gravelly, sandy soils for the most part. But a neighbor two doors up has a real clay problem in his soils. And you're like, well, what happened there? Well, a lot of our materials up here, they over time, as they've been deposited, get cross-cut by streams and other things, and then you get deposits in stream meanders and low spots in a stream bed and things like that, that you may get a clay deposit in one spot, and it's just like, where did this come from? And so, we have not only the big overriding landform controls on our soil textures, but then you have all kinds of other little things imposed over the top of it that you may find a spot where you get just a little bit of distance difference change the properties of the soil quite a bit.
So I'm envisioning when you went looking for a house, did you have a something that would tell you the pH of the soil before you bought the house?
I pretty much had a good idea what pH was no matter where we are in Cache Valley. But, we did have very specific areas where we wanted to be and where we knew we were going to get into fairly manageable soil property conditions. The advantages of maybe knowing what you were looking for, right?
But, I know when I went looking for my house, it wasn't the house so much as that sold us is that when we saw the garden area and that there were no rocks in it. It's like, okay, this is it. This is it.
Well, I grow a lot of rock because I am up on the bench. But
that gives you some advantage.
It does. With the coarser soils allow for a lot of things to move and get from place to place that need to be that you don't get in a finer textured soil.
But I'm also thinking about when I grew up in Mendon. Mendon kind of sits down into a, I won't call it a hole, but it there are a lot of springs that are in town. And I don't ever remember adding any chelated iron to my raspberries or strawberries. They just did fine. And I think probably in that location, because there were a lot of willows and trees that were there growing there, that kind of helped.
Probably had a little higher natural organic matter content and a little bit better pH balance in those that you didn't see the problem. Now, sometimes we don't see it with plants that have kind of evolved in these higher pH conditions because they're much more efficient at taking up what is available. Mm. And so we don't see it showing up in things like our box elder trees and our, you know, big tooth maples and things like that sometimes that you find that are natural to this area.
Don't grow silver maples. Yeah,
I was just going to say, when you start introducing things that are iron inefficient, that are used to more acidic conditions, they really suffer here. So choose plants wisely and look for things that are a little bit more efficient. Look for rootstocks in your fruits and even in raspberries and other things where they've been selected for higher pH conditions, semi-arid and arid areas. Yeah.
Now, I do need to, before we wrap up here, ask you about the chelated iron itself. What are you looking for in the store? It seems like I've noticed on packages, good for soils 7.0 and above or 7.5 and above. Even that little bit of difference can make a huge difference.
Right, and there's a whole bunch of different chelates that are out there, and you'll see three of the most common ones are EDTA, DTPA and EDDHA. And now those are, you know, the little kind of acronyms for the long molecular structure of them. But EDTA and DTPA don't work well in our really high pH soils. They break down so quickly that they've released all of their chelated iron
for the plant.
Almost immediately in our high pH soils. EDDHA is the form that we want to look for that's stable at our high pHs. And you'll see that indicated on the material with the number 138. And so it doesn't matter what the brand name is or anything like that. Typically, it'll say EDDHA or 138. It'll have that in the name. You'll see some of these like Fairy Plus or Sequestrine or some of those others that are pretty common will have the 138 designation. And that then indicates that that's the high pH stable material.
Now, I would recommend that first you have a soil test done. And in every county extension site, you can go in and get a little kit and it explains how to collect the soil from different locations. But you really need to know what is the pH of your soil.
Right.
Before, because you don't want to go out and buy iron, chelated iron. It could be really expensive. You want to know exactly what your soil's like. And the soil test, just a basic test, is fairly inexpensive.
Yeah, right now, the routine soil test that gives you your soil texture, your pH, your salt level in the soil, and your phosphorus and potassium nutrient levels costs you $14 a sample.
That's
nothing to know that.
Yeah, especially the information that it gives you.
Yeah, exactly. If you want more than that, you can actually ask for things like the zinc and the iron and some of the micronutrient contents as well, and that adds a little more expense. But even for a complete analysis, you know, 40-element scan, you know, all of the other things that are there, it's $50. So, I mean, if you wanted just a really good foundational complete analysis to start with and then use the routine to kind of monitor conditions over time, it doesn't cost that much to get really good target information that you need to manage it well. And, you know, you can ask for it to be sent to your county agent. All of the county agents will get a copy of the soil tests that are submitted so they can help interpret that if you wish. It can be routed to me even, and you can ask me to take a look at it, help you interpret it as well. And so we got a really good network of extensionists that can help you kind of interpret what's there in your soil test.
Well, Grant, this has been really helpful and very interesting information. Thank you very much.
Great. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Grant Cardin. He's USU's Extension Soil Specialist, and we'll have him back on again. I have a quick community calendar item from the Cache Naturalist Group. They have a guest speaker, Jack Green. He's going to talk about fall splendor, how our mountains outshine New England for exquisite colors. It's 6 p.m. on September the 2nd at the Bonneville Room at the Logan Library. Everyone is welcome, so I hope you go to that. And again, it's September 2nd at 6 p.m. with Jack Green, how our mountains outshine New England for exquisite colors. Up next is Petals and Prose.
This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose, and today I want to explore the matter of seeds. And you could say, as with what comes first, the chicken or the egg, in thinking about plants and flowers, we might ask which comes first, the seed or the plant. The answer is obvious in this question, because the seed has to come first. I'm going to be using a book called Seeds, or The Triumph of Seeds, by Thor Hansen. And he tells about when he was working on his PhD in the subject of conservation biology, in other words, biology that hopes to save plants that are vanishing. The plant he was working with is the almendro plant, growing mainly in Central America. He couldn't, he knew, be making trips back and forth to Central America, and so he chose the closest to the almendro seed, which is the avocado. Well, I'll be quoting from his book now. While everyone from gardeners and farmers to the characters in children's books trust that seeds will grow, what makes it happen? What lies inside these neat packages just waiting for the spark to build a new plant? When I finally decided to get to the bottom of these questions, my mind immediately pictured that sprouting almendro tree and how every part of its big seed was clearly visible, like the image in the textbook. Popping down to Costa Rica to find a fresh one was out of the question, but almendro is far from being the only species with large, easily sprouted seeds. In fact, nearly any grocery store, fruit stand, or Mexican restaurant keeps the big seeds and surrounding fruit of at least one rainforest tree always in good supply, and that is the avocado. In a brilliant piece of casting work, the title role for the movie Oh God went to George Burns. When asked about the greatest mistakes, the Burns Almighty deadpanned a quick response. Avocados, I should have made the pit smaller. Sous chefs in charge of guacamole would certainly agree, but to botany teachers around the world, the avocado pit is perfect. Inside its thin brown skin, all the elements of the seed are laid out in large format. Anyone wanting a front row seat for a lesson in germination needs nothing more than a clean avocado pit, three toothpicks, and a glass of water. The simplicity of it was not lost on early farmers who domesticated the avocado at least three different times from the rainforests of northern Mexico and Guatemala. Long before the rise of the Aztecs or the Mayans, people in Central America already enjoyed a diet rich with the creamy flesh of the avocado. I enjoyed it too, bringing on a spree of delicious sandwiches and nachos in preparation for my experiment. With a dozen fresh pits and a handful of toothpicks, I headed for the raccoon shack. And he explains that the raccoon shack was a little shack that had been inhabited by raccoons. And he was able to shoo the raccoons away, and he made this into his studio. He then tells about his teachers, Carol and Jerry Baskin. And I go to the text. Jerry and Baskin met on the first day of graduate school at Vanderbilt University, where they enrolled to study botany in the mid-1960s. We started right away, Carol told me. So they were seated next to one another when the professor came around assigning research topics. That was special because it was the first time we worked together, she remembered. It also marked the first time they turned their minds to a topic that would define their careers. Though they insist that their romance was typical, mutual friends, similar interests, there had been nothing standard about the intellectual partnership it fostered. Carol finished her doctorate a year ahead of Jerry, but they've been pretty much in sync ever since. publishing more than 450 scientific articles, chapters, and books on seeds. For a guided tour of an avocado pit, no one on the planet could have had better credentials. I tell my students that a seed is a baby plant in a box with its lunch, Carol said in one of our short conversations. She speaks with a southern drawl that has a casual way of explaining things. I like to take things a step further. Some of these babies have eaten all their lunch, some have eaten part of it, and some haven't even had a bite. Now Carol opened a window onto kinds of complexities that have kept her and Jerry fascinated for nearly 5 decades. Your avocado pit, she added knowingly, has eaten all its lunch. A seed contains 3 basic elements: the embryo of a plant, the baby, a seed coat, the box, and some kind of nutritive tissue, the lunch. Typically, the box opens up at germination, and the embryo feeds on lunch while it sends down a root and sprouts up its first green leaves. But it's also common for the baby to eat lunch ahead of time, transferring all of that energy into one or more incipient leaves called seed leaves or cotyledons. These are familiar halves of a peanut, walnut, or bean, embryonic leaves so large they take up most of the seed. As we were talking, I plucked an avocado pit from the pile on my desk, split it open with my thumbnail. Inside, I could see what she meant. The pale, nut-like cotyledons filled each half, surrounding a tiny nub that held the fledgling root and shoot. For a seed coat, the pit offered little more than varnish, thin, papery stuff that was already flaking off in brown sheets. Jerry and I study how seeds interact with their environment, Carol said. Why do seeds do what they do? She went on to explain that the avocado's strategy is somewhat unusual. Most seeds dry out as they open, using a thick protective coat to keep moisture at bay. Without water, the embryo's growth slows to a neat standstill, a state of arrested development that can persist for months, years, or even centuries. Until conditions are ripe for germination, but not avocados, she warned, if you let those pits dry out, they'll die. The way Carol said this reminded me that my avocado pits were living things. Like all seeds, they are live plants that have simply put development on pause, waiting until they land in just the right place at just the right time to send down roots and grow. For an avocado tree, the right place is somewhere its seeds will never desiccate, and the season is always right for sprouting. Its strategy relies on constant warmth and dampness. I tried to keep this in mind during the slow weeks before my avocado pits showed any signs of life. They became my silent, unchanging companions, 2 rows of mute brown lumps lined up on a bookshelf below the window. Although I have an advanced degree in botany, I have a long history of killing houseplants, and I began to fear for them. But like any good scientist, I took comfort in data, filling an elaborate spreadsheet with numbers and notes. Though nothing ever changed, there was a certain satisfaction in handling every seed dutifully, monitoring its weight and dimension. Thor Hansen and his studies with the Baskins, who were the best people he could have ever found for his particular subject, he tells how the Baskins' decades of work illustrate just how much there is to learn about what happens inside a germinating seed. Questions raised over 2,000 years ago by Theophrastus, the father of botany, continue to challenge scientists. As Aristotle's student and successor, Theophrastus, led exhaustive plant studies in the Lyceum, publishing books that remain definitive for centuries. Working on everything from chickpeas to frankincense, he described germination in great detail, wondering about seed longevity as well as differences in the seeds themselves, in the ground, in the state of the atmosphere, and in the season in which each is sown. In the long years since, researchers have unraveled many of the processes guiding dormancy, awakening, and growth. It is well established that germinating seeds imbibe water and extend their roots or shoots through cell expansion. This stage is followed by rapid cell division, fueled by the energy in their food reserves, but the exact cues that trigger and coordinate these events retain an aura of mystery. Germination chemistry alone involves a huge variety of reaction as the dormant metabolism comes to life, producing all the hormones, enzymes, and other compounds necessary to transform stored food into plant material. For avocados, that stored food includes everything from starch and protein to fatty oils and pure sugar, a mixture so rich that nurseries don't even bother with fertilizers until well beyond the seedling stage. Transferring my young trees to potting soil, I noticed that the cotyledons still clinging to the bases of the stems like pairs of upraised hands. Months or even years after rooting and leafing out, young avocado trees can still eke out a trickle of energy from the lunches their mothers packed. It's no coincidence that an avocado endows its offspring so generously. Like alamandros, avocados evolved to sprout in the deep shade of a rainforest, where light is scarce and where massive food reserves can give seedlings a distinct advantage. Their story and their seeds would be entirely different if they hailed from deserts or high mountain meadows, places where every young plant has a quick path to full sun. He goes on, but mainly I think his emphasis is to ask us to really consider the mystery of the seed. And he concludes, when it comes to stealing food from baby plants, no animal is more accomplished than Homo sapiens, and the importance of seeds in the human diet cannot be overstated. We take them everywhere we go, planting them, nurturing them, and devoting whole landscapes to their production. As Carol Baskin put it, when people ask me why seeds matter, I have one question for them. What did you eat for breakfast? Chances are that the meal began in a field of grass. I hope you'll think of the importance of seeds. This is Helen Cannon with Petals and Prose. Thank you for listening.
The Zesty Garden is a production of Utah Public Radio with producer Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. If you have an idea for an interview, including guests or topics, send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com. You're listening to KUST HD1 Moab, KCEU Price, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSR HD1 Logan, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.